Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Spots, you know, they cause such despair. I think it's like, you know, the phrase lousy comes mm-hmm. from if you've got nits, mm-hmm. it makes you feel lousy. You know, yeah. It makes you feel bad because yeah. you've got nits, you know. I think having spots is the same. I think something happens hormonally when you've got a bad breakout that makes you feel depressed. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's taken seriously enough at all.
Hello and welcome back. Today's guest is the writer Esther Corran. Esther wrote for lots of different newspapers before starting her successful blog Recipe Rifle, in which she documented being new to motherhood and learning to cook. She now has a brilliant website called The Spike, in which she talks about everything from fashion to bringing up children to finding the best cleaning products. It's really a smorgasbord of good advice and wise words. So, in this episode, we talk about that journey, we talk about what Esther did and how she got to where she is now in her career, and we also talk about the products that have been important to her and the facets of her appearance that have really affected the way she's felt. Here's Esther Corran. So let's talk about you as a very young girl.
Oh God, do we have to? I basically looked like that kid off the front of Mad. You won't know that. So there was an American magazine called Mad. Mm. And on the front was a kind of pudgy-faced, freckly, red-headed child. Okay. About sort of 6 or 7, kind of indeterminate. A bit like, it's like the American Dennis the Menace.
Right.
And he's the mad kid. And that's what I looked like. I had a round face, lots and lots of very pronounced freckles, and very, very red hair. And I was quite, I wasn't chubby, but I wasn't like, I wasn't one of like the pretty girls at primary school.
And did that, were you aware of that?
Yeah, really aware of it. Mm. Definitely. And also my sisters, none of my sisters have got red hair either. So
how many sisters?
I've got 3 sisters. Mm-hmm. And none of them got red hair. One of them is blonde. One of them is a brunette. And they were very tall with amazing legs and, you know, got these amazing tans. I just sort of stood out.
What did your mum look like?
My mother's also got red hair, but she's totally different. She's got green eyes. She's very slender. She's very kind of ethereal, wafty. She's an artist. Mm-hmm. So she, you know, we weren't on the same planet. Do you
right.
know what I mean?
Okay.
And my dad is a bit more like me. He's quite kind of, you know, he's got dark eyes and he just kind of thinks about stuff. But he mm-hmm. wasn't really around when I was little. He worked incredibly hard. Mm-hmm. He worked as a management consultant for oil companies and telecoms companies, so he was always traveling. He was always in like Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
He brought us back some amazing presents, but he wasn't there very much.
So you're in this household full of women that yes. you perceive to all be better looking than you,
without question.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then you're in school, and what yeah. you know, being I have friends who are ginger at school, and it wasn't overly lovely as an experience. Did you have any yeah. of that, or was that not a problem?
Do you know what? It wasn't really that bad in my girls' school. It was. I didn't really encounter any major prejudice until I got to university. Okay. I went to Bristol, and when I got there, there was being ginger was such a huge thing. I mean, there was a guy called Charles Walford who was actually a perfectly nice guy. I mean, we were friends, but he went on and on and on and on about the fact that I was ginger and I had red hair. And I think Chris Moyles was really, really popular at that time on Radio 1. And he had a big thing about gingers as well. Really nasty about gingers, really nasty about people with red hair. And Wally, Charles Walford Wally, he used to go on and on and on about it. And like, if we were having a conversation about anything, he would just go, yeah, but you're ginger. And then just walk away.
So
and that
nice.
Was the first, I mean, I always felt, you know, I've got red hair. If you've got red hair, other things go with it, you know, like whenever you get hot, you just sort of swell up basically, and your cheeks go really red really easily. And it's just not very, you know, you can be a different kind of redhead. You can be a kind of like pale, cool, pale, kind of really skinny redhead. Yeah. And then you can be a bit more of the kind of spuggy end of like redheadedness, which is okay. definitely what I was. So I've always, you know, I always very much felt like I was not Grace Kelly, you know.
Okay.
And there was like no, and the person I really wanted to be was Denise Van Outen, right? So she was my absolute beauty and style icon when I was sort of 17, because she was on Big Breakfast every morning. Mm. I used to watch the Big Breakfast when I went to school, and I just thought she was the most beautiful person I've ever seen in my life. And she used to wear these little cardigans, and she used to wear little kind of tiaras, and she had blonde hair, mm, and this beautiful perfect skin, and she was just, she's just so perfect.
And so did you have, you just said I wasn't a skinny redhead.
No.
What was your weight like at the time? Because
I was skinnier. I was skinny. As a child, mm-hmm, I was pretty pudgy. Mm-hmm. I was skinnier when I was sort of 15 or 16. Then I was sort of super skinny and stressed at school. And
were you concerned, were you always someone who was attractive to men, or did you feel that you had to be a certain version of yourself to be attractive to men?
That's a good question. When I was younger, I always used to try and make myself look so completely different from, mm-hmm, how I actually looked. Although it's, you can't really, when you've got red hair and loads of freckles and quite big boobs, there's not that much that you can do to make yourself look different. But I was constantly sort of trying to straighten, sort of sort my hair out, because my hair's sort of wavy.
Yeah.
But I wanted it straight. I wanted to look like Denise Van Outen. Yeah. You know, I must have looked an absolute fright, actually. Yeah. But did I find myself, I didn't, I never gave boys a chance,
right,
to sort of approach me organically. Do you know what I mean? I was so like aggressive with boys, mm-hmm, and I was so like, you know, come here you kind of thing, yeah, that I don't, and I made totally wrong choices, really shallow, just went for any boy I thought was handsome, mm-hmm, with no regard for whether they were funny or a nice person or, mm-hmm, anything,
right?
So I think that I sort of assumed that I wasn't very pretty, or that I wasn't pretty in the right sort of way. So I made a lot about being sort of sexy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had a nice figure, and I had big boobs, and I had big eyes, and, you know, lots of hair. And I think I didn't want to sort of be sitting around waiting to be picked in case I just sort of wasn't.
It's funny how sexy is so much more formulaic, or like a traditional version of sexy is so much more formulaic than beauty, which is really individual and...
Yeah.
A different thing. Whereas, you know, you said what's sexy, well, lots of hair,
yeah,
traditionally, you know, like
eyeliner, that sort of thing. I think sexy to me. I think, and also, you've got to remember, this is the 90s.
Right.
This is basically like 100,000 years ago, because it's pre-internet,
yeah,
pre-mobile phones and, yeah, everything. So the idea of, you know, people's idea of sexy or not sexy or beautiful, or not, I mean, the beautiful was quite standard then, mm, you know, it was.
What was beautiful then?
It was definitely Denise Van Outen. Pamela Anderson was still incredibly,
right,
popular.
Yeah.
Caprice, you, oh, know, yeah, yeah. So we're talking no clothes, yeah, Kelly Brook, yeah, no clothes on,
yeah,
lots and lots of blonde hair, fake boobs were a big thing,
mm-hmm,
and that was it. And you either, and now it's amazing because so many different, you can look so many different ways, and it's all great, and it's all celebrated, yeah, yeah, and it's all brilliant. And, yeah, the whole, you know, a whole world of like freckle fanciers has been kind of opened up by the internet.
Yeah, freckles are massive now.
I know, exactly.
People love them.
And you have, yeah, there are loads of like quite big models with, you know, very pronounced, yeah, freckles. Yeah.
Tell me about your personality then at this point. So you said that you were sort of effectively using your personality to get past your conceived shortcomings, your,
yeah,
preconceived shortcomings. Were you someone who thought very early on, I'm going to write, I'm going to be bookish, I'm going to do this with my life? Or were you someone who just had quite a big personality and then you sort of wanted to find the right career for it?
Well, there was never, I mean, at home, I had three sisters, so it was quite loud. And my dad was, before I was born, my dad was an academic, and then I was born and he thought, I better get a job.
Right.
So my dad is very, very academic and, you know, bright, but works incredibly hard. And my mother values jokes and telling stories above everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not my mother's fault, but as it happens, we were never encouraged to be nice. Niceness, being kind, I think they both kind of thought maybe that was a given or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But actually, every day, it was just war. It was just like verbal war.
Mm-hmm.
At dinner time, with each other. We didn't really sort of physically hit each other. It was just, we just went for each other with words all the time. Mm-hmm. And whoever was the meanest and the funniest, then my mother would laugh. And getting my mum to laugh was the thing, or getting my dad to laugh was the thing. So I grew up with an intensely competitive atmosphere at home. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realise until really quite late in life that actually niceness is a currency. Mm-hmm. And I got to university, and at Westminster, where I was at school, you know, being verbally very dexterous was fine as well. And you could be mean and people would like you anyway, and that was all fine. I got to university and I realised there were all these pathetic girls who were just really nice. But she's lovely, she's so nice, she's so and I was like, my God, I've got to change. I mean, I felt like a scientist who realised that their entire life's work was poisoning people.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I felt like I'd invented a drug to cure people that was turning them blind or something. I was like, this is my life's work, is to just be, you know, funny and mean and like on it and smart. And actually, nobody cares. People just want you to be nice.
Right.
Dude, just want you to be nice. And I thought, oh my God, I've been doing this wrong my whole life. Because being nice is so much easier than being funny or clever or anything.
Yeah.
So university was a big, like, it was a big black hole in terms of, like, my personality. Right. You know.
But you made friends there?
I made friends with people who worked on the newspaper. Okay. Yeah, I worked for my student newspaper and mm-hmm. I made friends with them.
So you were writing then?
Yeah,
something that you always did?
Always. Okay. Oh, in terms of the writing was from, I've got my little diaries from when I was like 8 years old.
Fine, okay, so that was always a thing for you.
Forever and ever. There was an old electric typewriter. Again, no computers in my house, no laptops, nothing. Mm. It was longhand or an old electric typewriter.
But were you ambitious, or was it something you were just doing for fun?
No, I was super ambitious. Okay. Oh my God, I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to work for a newspaper. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand what that meant.
Right.
But I wanted to work for it. I didn't want to write books.
Was there anyone you looked up to?
God, that's a good question. It's a long time ago now. Probably my husband. He's so much older than me. No, who did I look up to?
I mean, I was thinking more Lois Lane than real people. Was there anyone who sparked that idea in your head?
Oh, well, Press Gazette, of course. I always forget about Press Gazette. Press Gang, not Press Gazette. Press Gazette is the possibly now even defunct. Press Gang was my favourite show.
Okay.
Julia Sawala as Linda. Dexter Fletcher as Spike. I actually met Dexter Fletcher the other day and it was incredibly exciting. I don't think I've ever kind of dried up in front of a famous person before. But totally dried up.
Did he seem a bit surprised that you were so excited?
No, my husband had prepared him for the fact that I was a big Spike fan.
Yeah.
I watched all of Press Gang again. I bought them all on DVDs when I was pregnant because I was feeling a bit mad. Mm. And watched them all again. And they hold up. They're so good.
Yeah.
I wanted to be Juliet Sawala in Press Gang.
Fine.
Stamping around going, you're fired. Where's your copy?
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, so you're at uni, you're learning to be kind.
I'm really doing my best, I'm doing my best.
Yeah, and then what happens next in your life?
At university was a nightmare. I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't especially want to go.
What did you do?
I did English.
Okay.
Yeah, and I didn't especially want to go to university. I was on the verge of saying to my school and saying to my parents, look, I really, really don't want to go. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in this. I'm not interested in learning anything else. I just want to go and be a journalist, please. Just can I just live at home and go and work for the Ham and High?
Yeah.
But I didn't.
Where were you growing up?
I just found a corner in Hampstead Garden suburb. London. Yeah. But I didn't because it was unthinkable. Mm-hmm. Even Westminster was quite a liberal school. It really was unthinkable that you wouldn't go to university. Right. I think now people would be more open to it if you had a plan.
For sure, yeah.
So I went to university from the word go. I was just like, this is a nightmare. I didn't understand what was going on in my course. I wasn't intellectually engaged at all. I didn't understand. What were you talking about? You know, the essay titles. I was like, this is not like school. School was really easy. They just said, do this, do that, read it, and you'll get an A. Yeah. Easy.
Yeah.
University, it was like, you know, what is the self? What is the now? And you're like, oh my God, give me a break.
Yeah.
So I sort of sought refuge in a student paper. And from the student, from there, I applied to City University postgraduate diploma in periodical journalism. Mm-hmm. And I very nearly didn't get in because I got a 2-2, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, I got a 2-2 in my degree. And my tutor, George Donaldson, didn't write me a very nice reference for City University. But I had done huge amounts of work for the student paper, so I was obviously incredibly keen. So in my interview, she said, your tutor has not written you a very good reference. And I said, that's because I hate university, but I love it here. I don't want to be a journalist, and I wish I hadn't gone to university. Mm-hmm. This is where I belong. And she went, all right.
What were you writing about?
At student paper?
Yeah.
Ridiculous student stuff. Like, I used to write a column called The Bristolian, which was like an anonymous Bristol student going to all the kind of nights.
Right, so like reviews almost.
Sort of. Pretty much anything. It was a pretty slack affair. I mean, we sort of rolled around having fun. I mean, we didn't really... We won... No, I think we are the only student paper to have never won a single award for anything ever.
Wow.
I mean, we just totally took the piss, but it was brilliant.
Was there anything that the first product you discovered when you were younger or... You know, because it sounds like... Effectively, you found your look quite early. Is that
lots of eyeliner. Hair and eyeliner. I've never really got on with lipstick. I don't really understand lipstick. I can't really keep it on. I talk too much, it falls off.
Yeah.
I'm always eating, you know, drinking coffee or something. So I've never understood how one would put on lipstick and then keep it on. So lipstick was a no. Mm-hmm. I had quite not bad skin. The skin in between my massive craterous outbreaks was actually very nice skin.
Right.
But it was a massive craterous outbreak.
That's very common though of people who have breakouts because because your skin is effectively more oily, so it's lovely and lubricated and soft. But then you get these
huge volcanoes I had. They could be seen from outer space when I was a teenager. And my mother, who is an artist, very bohemian, a beautiful skin.
Mm. Did she wear makeup?
Never. Never wore makeup. So we were, and didn't know anything about it.
And your sisters?
Yes. Oh, well, my elder sister, Harriet, she's very, very stern, blue stocking. She did a degree in physics. And also, perfect teeth, beautiful skin, beautiful blonde hair, blue eyes. Why would she wear makeup? Yeah. Why? She's not a trollop, you know. Yeah. So it was left up to my other sister, who also had perfect skin and was very tall and beautiful and she great big eyes and just gorgeous. But she was more interested in kind of boys and going
out. There were four of you or three of you?
There were four of us together.
Okay.
And then the littlest one didn't come along until a bit later.
A bit later, fine.
So my elder sister's, Hannah, who's the one just above me, she sort of wore makeup. And I really had to look to her for kind of guidance.
Did you steal her stuff?
I did not steal her stuff because she would have killed me, I think, if I'd stolen her stuff. But I think we always used to go... She went to Boots to buy me and I went to Boots. Anyway, we was poke around in Boots. We didn't really know what we were buying.
Mm.
And then I started to get these terrible spots.
Mm.
And I discovered Conceal the Blemish Concealer by Rimmel, $2.99. And my colour was ivory. And it did the miraculous thing of covering up my spots.
Yeah.
Which was really, like, no small thing.
Yeah.
You know, and you just think, what am I going to do? And spots, you know, they cause such despair. And it's not... I think it's like, you know, the phrase lousy comes from if you've got nits, it makes you feel lousy. You know, it makes you feel bad
because
you've got nits, you know. I think having spots is the same.
Yeah.
I think something happens hormonally when you've got a bad breakout that makes you feel depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's taken seriously enough at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to the doctor and they go, I can't see anything or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Being able to not see them, be able to just at least pretend, the illusion that your skin isn't bad, was a huge, great big deal to me. So yeah, Rimmel concealer. I have a lot of stubs of Rimmel concealer floating. I've got some now.
Were you putting it on with your fingers?
Yeah, always with my fingers.
Just dabbing it on.
Dabbing it on carefully. Tissue concealer. I hadn't quite discovered powder yet.
Yeah. But you were good at it. You weren't someone who see the line.
I was a master of disguise.
Right.
Absolute master of disguise. People were like, what? I mean, what spots? I'm like, this one that's changed the shape of my chin.
Yes. Yeah.
Horrendous.
It's when your face changes slightly that I find that I've always felt the worst about spots because you feel like you can feel it when you talk. You can feel it when you move. It's like everything's changed.
It's just, it's... people are going to say, any third world problem. I'm sure people in the third world have spots too, and I'm sure they hate them as well. It's really nasty.
It's really hideous. Yeah. I need to talk to you while we're there about hair and eyeliner, because I've written that down as being your signature look.
It is.
Was that already the thing when you were 18, or did it take you a bit longer to come to that?
No, I think the thing when I was 18 was the thing that I think people... Yeah, no, eyes, very much eyes. I was always into my eyes, because... I've got quite pale eyelashes, not really pale, but quite pale eyelashes, which I wanted to, you know, conceal, because I didn't want to look like Boris Becker, basically. So there was always lots and lots of eyeliner, Clinique eyeshadow in a kind of dark purple. It was kind of called Aubergine or something like that. Yeah. I loved that.
I think I know exactly which one, because my sister used to buy it.
It's got upstairs. I've got one upstairs. Yeah, yeah. It's about 25
years. Is it in a plastic sort of
It's
rectangle.
In a plastic, little plastic tray. Yeah. And it's kind of a little strip, and it had a mirror on the inside.
Yes.
So I would just sort of ring my eyes several times with that, and lots and lots of mascara on. And then my hair... The solution to my hair was so simple, but I didn't actually come across it for a long time. I had a layered bob, a la Jennifer Aniston.
Okay.
But I didn't know how to look after it, so it just kind of went all over the place.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't actually until quite recently that I grew my hair down to the floor and, like...
It's interesting you say that, because I think you put a picture of yourself up a while ago where you had shorter hair. And I thought, it's odd that this hair looks like it looks comfortable. And I feel like a lot of finding the right haircut for you is finding the haircut that is comfortable for your hair texture and your way of wearing your hair, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And when you go into a hairdresser and they wet your hair and then they cut it into a mad shape, you're then like, yeah, but this isn't me.
No.
Like, you can make it look like this person, but it has to be like me. And I feel like maybe it takes time to find that.
I've just always naturally assumed that I have to fight against everything that I naturally am.
Yeah.
And actually, you have to be quite old to realise that... how do I express this? To realise that you have to work with what you've got rather than just trying to hold back the tide all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure people will be rolling their eyes going, no, but you don't understand. I've got a massive nose, or I've got a thing, or I've got all my hair is something.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a friend at university who had very curly hair. And she was always trying to straighten it. Or people were always like, try to straighten it. And it looked ghastly. I was like, no, don't try and straighten it.
Yeah.
Let's find some curly hair product and make it more curly.
It's kind of in line with the idea that effectively everyone's beautiful. You just have to find the way to enhance the thing that makes them beautiful. And like choose the thing that you enhance, almost.
Exactly. And I didn't understand that my hair wasn't the problem.
Right.
It was what I was doing to it that was the problem. Yeah. Left to its own devices, my hair's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
You know, just left to dry on its own.
So what were you doing at the time then?
So I went through several phases of hair care.
Mm.
After hideous choppy bob that I got at Tony and Guy, I found the most wonderful hairdresser called Nadia. She works at John Frieda. Yes. And she started giving me... I said, I want to grow my hair. And she said, great, let's grow your hair. And she gave it a kind of cut and I sort of grew it. And then I had kids and chopped it all off, which was a mistake. And then I grew it again. And then I looked at a magazine or looked at a picture of my mum in the 70s or something. I can't remember what it was.
Mm.
And there was just a girl there with maybe a Woodstock or something. And she had her hair parted in the middle and kind of going down there, down to about there. And I was like, that's what I want to look like. That is what I want to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember how I discovered...
Do you still have this picture?
No. I don't know where it is.
Yeah.
It may have been on my mother, because that's what her hair was like. Mm. There's a picture of her holding a guitar with her hair. I'll try and find it. I don't know where it is. And it sort of 70s things were slightly creeping back. And I just thought, that's it. That's what I should look like.
Mm.
And so I got Nadia to do me a cut with my hair parted dead in the middle. And I grew it as long as I possibly could. And stopped using hair irons. Stopped using GHD.
Okay. You were using GHDs when you were younger,
I was using GHDs, which for the first time in my life gave me some control over my hair. And I can't remember how I came across it, but I came across a kind of air drying mousse.
Mm.
And I stopped blow drying my whole hair, which just made it really fluffy and frizzy and horrible. Because I could never be bothered to do that thing.
Have absolutely no idea. No. I can't do it either. There's no way.
So boring.
Yeah.
I'm never going to do that.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to do that anymore. So I just dried the front bit, the fringe, to make it kind of behave.
Yeah.
And then I left the rest with some product in to dry naturally.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was suddenly like, oh my God, this is what I would be in the wild.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
In prehistoric times, me as a Neanderthal, this is what my hair would have been like.
Yeah.
And this
yeah.
is what and it's supposed worked. To be like.
Yeah.
And I just felt like, do you know what I felt? I felt like I will make sure that this is what I do with my daughter.
Yeah.
When she's flounding around going, no, I want blue hair, I want pink hair. And I'm going, no, let's just take what you've got and do that, but just more so.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would have saved myself years of heartache.
I do think experimenting is quite a good thing, though. To A, have right. seen yourself looking hideous, yeah. and to know that now you have reached a point at which you're comfortable.
My nirvana.
Yeah,
hair
exactly.
nirvana.
Yeah, it is quite good. And looking back at... But it is sad when, for example, I now have a lot of grey hairs. I've had every colour under the sun, and people would say to me, enjoy your sort of chestnut hair because it will go grey at some point. And I was like, no, I want peroxide hair. I want red hair. And now I'm like, I should have just enjoyed that and now have my bonkers hair face. Because now I have to dye it to my natural colour, which is so annoying.
So what have you got now?
This is my colour, pretty much, with some balayage in.
Right.
But I've got greys, which I have today covered with a Colour Wow thing. But they drive me mad. Do you colour your hair now?
No.
Not at all?
I don't do anything to it. No, I had balayage in my hair years ago, and years ago. And I said to Nadia, my ends are still really, really blonde.
Yeah.
And she said, well, how much time do you spend in the sun? And I went, well, a lot.
Yeah.
And also, I'm just a bit older, my hair's just getting lighter anyway, and I've got greys in it. But if you're red, if you've got red hair,
you can cover
if you're lucky, you can they just kind of blend in.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about your sun habit, because you did just mention that you like
sunshine.
The sun.
Oh my God, I love a bit of sunshine. I'm a bit, it's...
But with freckles, the sun is not your friend.
It's my friend!
No, it's
not. Other freckles, I don't like other people with freckles. I do like the sun. I've got a vitamin D problem, which is that most redheads or pale people should be able to synthesize vitamin D very effectively even when it's cloudy.
Right.
Because we have to.
We're meant to hail from Scandinavia.
We're meant
right?
to come from Denmark and Scandinavia and around there where there is no sun.
Right.
So you have to.
Yeah.
But it turns out that I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I am a freak in all manner of different ways. Mm-hmm. I've got a weird blood type. I can't synthesize vitamin D properly. So I love sunbathing.
Okay.
Not hours and hours and hours and hours, but I do like sitting in the sun a lot. I wear sunscreen, but I don't go nuts. I'm not a big factor 50 person. So I do like going in the sun.
Do you wear SPF every day on your face?
I have seen the light and I'm trying my best, and I have a very nice I don't know how you pronounce it, Merlin and Goetz a thing that it's in my downstairs bathroom, and I just put a little on there. But it is a habit. I am 38 years old and new habits are quite hard to form, and I'm trying my hardest.
Okay, excellent. I'll tick off that then.
No,
okay, so you do need to wear it every day.
I know.
So okay, so you leave, you go and do your course, your journalism course, and you enjoy that.
Yes, it was amazing.
Okay,
it was amazing. It was just.
And what happens next then?
Part of the course was a lot of work experience.
Okay,
you were supposed to do work experience in every holiday, and they didn't let you get away with not. And you had to find somewhere to go, and you had to do it, and you had to, you know. And before you went on your work experience, they gave you a big pep talk about how you were going to get a piece in that magazine that you were working for, and you were going to be paid for it. There was no thing of, you know, just doing it for free or being taken advantage of.
Right.
They were really hot.
That sounds
on, like,
great. Though.
Yeah, they were really hot on, like, you are a journalist, you have done a piece of work, you will be paid for it.
Right.
I did lots of work experience. My first paid job was at a News Digest magazine called The Week.
Okay.
Because they needed somebody and I was there and I quite liked it.
Mm-hmm.
It was mainly photocopying, and I stayed there for about 18 months. At the same time, I was also working 2 days a week at the Times magazine.
Okay. And so where were you living?
I lived at home.
Okay.
Yeah, I lived at home.
Handy.
This whole time, very handy.
Yeah.
And when I got into the Times, that changed everything because they gave me a Times email address.
Okay.
And once I had my Times email address, I could email everybody in the whole of the Times saying, hi there, I'm doing some freelancing on the magazine. I was wondering if you needed some help in obituaries or in, you know, public agenda and career or any of these kind of tiny departments where I thought they might need a hand. So, yeah, so that was great. Mm. And I did that for a bit. And then I worked on the Times Diary for Andrew Pearce for a bit.
Mm.
And then I started doing a bit of work for the Evening Standard. And there, one of their journalists left.
Mm-hmm.
And so I then worked on the Evening Standard Diary for about 2 years.
Were you quite confident throughout this time? It sounds like, I mean, when you reel it off like that, it sounds very almost formulaic. Like, I did this and then I did that. But, I mean, from my experience and certainly from other people I've spoken to, there's a degree of nerves, imposter syndrome, feeling like, will I ever work? Did you have any of that? Or was it
I've never had imposter syndrome.
Okay.
Because I've always, always, always wanted to do this.
Okay.
It's been my entire life to be a writer and to make money from writing.
Right.
So I, at no point, my problem, my two main problems are hubris and too high self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And genuinely that is a problem. I think I am much, much better and cleverer and funnier and prettier than I actually am.
Oh, that's such a great way to be.
It's so not a great way to be.
Why?
Because you come up against the reality all the time.
But then doesn't the reality tarnish your view of yourself?
I just say it must be a mistake. Or that can't be a photo of me.
Amazing.
But no, broadly, I sail through life thinking that everything I do is amazing.
Fine.
Everything's brilliant.
Great.
There is a thing where I think, but I'm not, because there's just piles of junk in my house and I'm not as successful as I would like to be.
Sound slightly sexist, but do you think that's quite a masculine view? I mean, thinking about it, I think that women will often say, yeah, I have this feeling of da 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 da. Whereas actually, you've just said, I've heard lots of men say plenty of times.
Yes, I am quite butch in lots of ways. I don't have a thing about my body. People say, oh, I don't like my hands or I don't like my... I genuinely think that I've been dealt a perfectly all right hand.
But
sometimes I will look at my pictures of myself and think, oh my God, who is that person?
Right,
just not me.
Doesn't tally up
with the picture in my head.
But about weight, so you often talk about skinny being something that you like.
Yeah.
And A, is that something that you've had to work hard to achieve? And B, has there been a backlash to that? I mean, it's not overly popular as a view at the moment.
Mm. No, when you say popular, I mean, I'm sent emails and asked questions about diets all the time.
Mm-hmm.
How do I lose weight? How do I stay slim? It's not thin. People aren't saying, I want to be an anorexic. You know, nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. I mean, it's not that. It's people going, I just can't seem to shift this half a stone that I would like to lose. They're not being unrealistic.
No.
They're only sort of 10 stone and they want to be 9.5 stone.
Yeah.
Oh, fine. That's probably the way you probably should be with their height and situation.
Yeah.
But I was always... I have had periods where I have been overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely don't mind what other weight people are. It is not a moral issue at all. I do not like being overweight. I just don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like myself. I don't feel like I look the way that I would like to look in my clothes.
Mm-hmm.
My fighting weight has always been about 8.5 stone.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had children and just... I was...
How tall are you?
5'6".
Okay, fine. So that is quite... I mean, that's really slim.
8.5 stone, 5'6", that's fine.
Yeah, but slim. Yeah. It's on the slimmer end of
absolutely.
That.
But that's what I always was.
Yeah.
I was always 8.5 stone. And then I had children and I just put on about 3 stone. And it was so unpleasant. I mean, I really hated it.
Mm.
So I had Kitty put on 3 stone, then got back down and then had Sam and put on 3 stone and then just couldn't get rid of it.
Okay. How did you get rid of it?
Well, I got rid of it by not really eating anything. But that's quite hard when you've got small children. When you've got small children, you're tired all the time.
Yeah.
And we were talking before about you end up eating everything everyone gives you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's too much to ask of the mother of small children. Who, when you're doing a lot of the childcare, if you sort of go back to work and you've got a bit of, got some sort of defined structure to your day, you can focus on what you're eating and you're busy, you know. When you're looking after small children, God almighty, I mean, it's the custard creams that keep you going, you know, it's just like one, two, more coffee, 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 more, 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 more. And there's, you know, and then your husband, in the evening, you want to talk to your husband, so you have this kind of big dinner of stuff, and hooray, and it's food, and it's a kind of really joyful thing. You're like, children are joyful, but there's also a lot of stress and a lot of ugliness with kind of small children and babies. You know, there's a lot of shit and puke and bad smells and crying and falling over. And it's really, really, really hard work. So to also not just eat whatever you want is too cruel.
Right.
So my children grew up a bit. And then the honest answer is I got a horrendous chest infection. Mm-hmm. And it went on for 3 months, and I had 2 really long courses of antibiotics that made me feel really sick. Mm-hmm. So I had 2 periods of feeling just sick for 10 days, and I lost a stone. I lost half a stone, and then I went, oh my God, I've lost half a stone. I'm going to eat nothing for a week and lose the other half a stone. So I literally miso soup and crackers, for, which I like, by the way, miso soup and crackers, and lost the other half a stone and then didn't put it back on.
Okay, but when you do that, so I've lost weight through being ill, tonsillitis and stuff, but sometimes when I come out of it, I feel weak. I don't feel like I've lost fat necessarily. Right. So did you feel like your body had gone back to what you wanted it to be? Okay, so it wasn't just a case of...
I really felt like I was finally back to what I was supposed to be.
Okay.
And the fact that in a year I haven't put it back on has made me think, and I'm eating normally. I mean, I don't eat nearly as much meat as I used to, but you know, I don't really miss it or want to, it's fine. I don't eat as much meat as I used to. I don't eat as much as I used to, but I'm not looking after tiny children.
So. And you're quite busy. I mean, you said to me earlier that you get up, what, at 7:30 to lie in.
Yeah.
Massive lie in.
Yeah, 7:30 is like...
And you go to bed early. So you're active throughout the day, but do you exercise?
Not really. I did. I went through a long period before when I really, I felt like I was a stone overweight and I couldn't shift it. And I wasn't eating a huge amount. I did a lot of spin, a lot of swimming. Now I walk everywhere. And I go swimming a bit, but no, I don't go swimming.
But you're active.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I don't sit down at a desk much.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You're doing obituaries. Just jumping around here, but you're doing obituaries.
You're keeping amazing track of my life story.
Back and forth.
Fantastic.
And what happens next?
What did happen next? I went to work at the Evening Standard. I got a job on the desk at the Evening Standard Diary, I did that for 2 years. And then I met my husband, which compromised.
Where did you meet? That.
I had met my husband before because he's a friend of my brother-in-law's.
But
we didn't actually meet properly until 2007 at a book party.
Which brother-in-law is this? My physicist?
My brother-in-law is called Alexander Armstrong. He's a game show host and he's married to my sister.
Which sister?
Hannah, the second one down.
Okay.
So he presents a show called Pointless.
Right.
On...
I'm obsessed with family trees. I like the Mitfords. So I know... So I like to see the spider webs in my head. Okay, fine. Go on. So you met your husband before and then you met him again.
I met him at my sister's engagement party. Mm. And then he got engaged to someone else and I went out with someone else. And then he split up with his fiance, and then we got together at a book party. Very, very hot July night.
Okay.
Book party. It was very, you know, sultry and romantic.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds
like something from a film.
It was totally something like something from a film.
Yeah.
And then we got together and then... But then his father died quite shortly afterwards. So that was just... And we were like a very new... And it was just... So we didn't really... Nothing really happened until the following sort of January. We didn't really kind of properly get together until the following year.
How long ago-ish was that?
I was 27, so that was 11 years ago.
So you're working at the Standard. You've got this new sparkly boyfriend that you fancy.
Yeah.
And then what are you writing at the Standard?
I was writing gossip. So I was on the diary. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was already getting a little bit boring, a little bit old. And I felt like I was getting a little bit old to be doing gossip. And so then I was offered a job out of the blue. I was offered a job at The Independent.
Okay.
And I thought, well, I better leave the Stand anyway, because Giles had got lots of famous friends. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I can't really do this job. It was just too compromising. You know, I couldn't really mesh the two.
Okay.
So I left and I went to work at The Independent, which was a features writing job, which was in theory everything I'd always wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really unhappy. I really, really didn't like it. I didn't... At The Independent... they just weren't very nice. Okay. No, it wasn't... No, do you know what? It's not that they weren't very nice. We just didn't get on.
Okay.
I was the wrong person for that job. And I ended up saying, this is not the way to run a newspaper. This is like a sixth form newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was called in by the editor, features editor, who said that if I didn't stop behaving myself, then they were going to fire me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I'm sorry, I can't work here anymore. I quit.
Amazing. And did you just walk out?
No, I actually sort of cried a little bit.
Okay.
I hated it so much.
Yeah.
And I was so kind of relieved / scared that it had come to this.
Mm.
That I sort of said, I just can't do this job anymore. Like that. And I should have just gone, F you and your effing newspaper. But I didn't.
Yeah.
I was so stressed and like upset that I sort of, some tears came to my eyes.
But also when you get to that point where you know you're going to cry, it just happens to you.
It just happens to
you. And you can't stop it. And it's just annoying.
I used to be such a crier. Like any stress or like upset or conflict used to make me cry. Not anymore. But it used to really make me cry.
Yeah.
So I left. I came home and Giles was horrified.
So at this point, so you're living together.
I was living here in my house. We were living together, and Giles worked here at home, and he was just like, he just sort of couldn't believe I quit my job.
Okay.
He was just like, I just don't understand why you didn't wait for them to fire you, because then they have to pay you money.
Oh.
And I went, oh yeah, I forgot about money.
Yeah.
So I came back, and that was then the kind of the beginning of something.
Okay.
Something else.
So then what happened next?
I got incredibly depressed for about 3 months, because just after I left, Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, there was no money, there was no advertising, there was no budget, there were no freelance jobs, there was nothing, there was no work.
Mm-hmm.
And I left The Independent thinking, well, I'll just, you know, once word gets out that I'm available, the phone won't stop ringing. I refer you to my aforementioned hubris and high self-esteem. And it didn't.
Mm.
Nobody rang, nobody called, nobody wanted anything. I would regularly send my friend, my contact on the Daily Mail, I would send her every week, I would send her 3 ideas, 5 ideas, da 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 da. She'd go, great, thanks, great, thanks, great, thanks. And they would all appear in the paper being written by other people.
Oh, that is so annoying.
So I just gave up. I just went, I just don't know. I mean, what, you know, because at the time, all my little journalism friends were all still really junior.
Yeah.
So no one would... No, I mean, obviously, you know, it's a racket. All commissioning editors commission their friends.
Yeah.
So I didn't have any mates who were kind of high-ups.
Yeah.
And the Times wouldn't touch me because I was going out with Giles, and they didn't want to be accused of, like, nepotism. They were like, we don't want, you know, you're Giles' girlfriend.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, fucking cheers.
Yeah.
It was really desperate.
Yeah.
It was desperate.
So what were you doing on a day-to-day basis then?
I was teaching myself how to cook.
Okay.
Because I thought, right, I'm here now, I'm in Giles' house, we're not married, he could kick me out at any time.
So this is the thing, because it's a difficult situation to be living in someone else's house without a job when you're going out with them, and everything hangs on the relationship going well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Giles, incredibly nice and supportive.
Yeah.
And we were getting on great.
I mean, I expect that you wouldn't have married him otherwise, but you know, it's still quite a difficult situation to be in.
I was nervous.
Yeah.
I was nervous. I was like, my God, I've got to make use of myself. I really do.
Yeah.
So I taught myself how to cook.
Right.
Because Giles was really into it. He was like, yeah, brilliant. Learn how to cook. Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, that's
great. Had you been a good cook before that?
No, I didn't know. I literally not a clue.
Okay.
I mean, my mother was a good cook.
Mm.
My mother has no known faults.
Mm-hmm.
She's not one of life's teachers at all.
Okay.
And so it was very much like, off you go, learn for yourselves. Yeah. And actually, you know, it's quite hard.
Right.
And I hadn't been interested in food because I didn't eat very much. Mm-hmm. And Giles was a good cook, so mm-hmm. we either went out, and also we had no children, so we just went out all the time. Yeah. Oh, I'm hungry, I will just go to the pub, and they yeah. would give me, the innkeeper will give me some food.
Yeah.
So, you know, cooking was not a thing that had to happen, but yeah. I felt like it was something that I needed to get
grips. So you very consciously made it your project.
Yeah,
it wasn't definitely. Like you just sort of thought, oh, today I'm going to cook because I've got nothing else to do. You actually thought, I'm going to learn this and I'm going
to
do it
properly. I said, I'm going to learn how to cook. I'm okay. going to teach my house. Oh, no, I did not do it properly. No,
okay.
no, no, no.
Oh, okay,
no, no.
Fine.
I didn't do yeah. anything properly.
Okay.
I go at everything like a bull in a china shop going, this is going to be fantastic. And then it's not. So, I no, no, no. If it wasn't like, what's mm. that girl who did that French, she started at the beginning of some cookbook and cooked everything until the
end. Oh, that Mel
Julie and Julia. Julia.
Okay.
So I started by teaching myself how to make a pork pie, which is probably the hardest thing. It's the thing that makes them all cry in Bake Off.
It would never even occur to me to make a pork pie.
Why would you?
I mean, it's not something I'd eat.
Buy one from the shop.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
mad. I tried to make Turkish Delight. What was I thinking? Really weird.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that you start with a, you know, with a white sauce.
Yeah.
You start with identifying different cuts of meat.
Did you have a book you were following or just...
No, I had from my little flat that I lived in when I was working in the Evening Standard, I had bought myself Nigella Express.
Okay.
And I loved the photographs and I loved the fact that it all seemed really easy.
Mm.
So all the first things that I cooked were from Nigella Express.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I thought she'd invented ceviche. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I really thought, like, you know, she knows everything.
Yeah.
She is the queen of food. And I started there and then I went to some sort of Jamie Oliver. And now I just kind of think, because also we're going to lots of restaurants as well. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I would eat things I've never eaten before and just think, I wonder, I like that flavour. Maybe I could do something with that flavour at home.
Yeah.
So it was completely mad and scattergun and random. And
yeah.
It was also some things that my mother used to cook for us when we were little, sort of lamb shank stew and stuff like that. So stews and... Blogging was still quite a new thing. It was still quite...
When's this, 2008, 9?
Yeah, 2008.
Okay.
Blogging was still quite a new thing.
Mm.
And it was mostly done by... photographers. It was mostly done by people who could write but who could mainly take amazing photos.
Yeah.
And the food blogs that were around at that time were just stunning. I mean, it was stunning visually. I mean, they are now as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were, I mean, Miss Marmite lover, Kirsten Rogers, she was a really, really big food blogger. She ran a supper club. And it was right at the beginning of hipsterism. So it was right at the start of cocktails and jam jars and that kind of stuff. And she just took these beautiful photographs. And there was no way I could do any of that.
Yeah.
I'm just visually totally incompetent.
But it's interesting that you made the connection immediately. So A, blogging was very new then.
Mm.
And B, there you are cooking away. And yet your brain immediately runs to, what can I do with this?
I was always used to writing something.
Okay, so your life, whatever you're doing, things are lighting
about
up.
It somewhere.
Fine.
And I had just come off The Independent and I was used to writing thousands of words a week at The Independent. And that was great and that suited me fine.
Mm.
But I needed to do something with it because I couldn't I couldn't just not write about it. So I thought, right, I'll start a blog about cooking, about food. And I thought, obviously, being me, I went into it going, I am going to be the new Nigella of food blogs.
Yeah.
But I realised that I didn't have a camera. I couldn't take a photo, even if I did have a camera. And I, you know, it was just like splot, you know, there it was. But what I can do is write about a real experience.
Okay.
I started the blog in sort of October, and in January I deleted it because I was like, this is embarrassing, what am I doing, this is a complete waste of time. And then I got a message on Twitter, which was still very little then as well, someone saying, have you deleted your blog? I really, really enjoyed it. What's happened? Can you bring it back? And I thought, my God, if one person is reading it and enjoying it, that's enough for me.
Yeah.
And so I reinstated it and then went hard on the kind of hopeless cook,
right,
which was broadly true,
yeah,
the kind of hopeless cook angle. And put more, and Liberty London girl, who was a very early reader as well, Sasha, she's terribly nice and always been hugely supportive, she got in touch and said, you really need more photos, you just got, it doesn't matter how bad they are, you've got to put photos on there. And I went, okay, I will. This is before iPhones, by the way. Mm-hmm. it was really hard
to
take a photo and upload it really took ages.
So
I did that. I put a photo with everything and wrote, and it suddenly became really successful. It suddenly became a thing.
So when you say really successful...
Yeah, I know, it's qualified, yes. What do I mean by
that? Yeah, what do you mean by that? Yeah. Because the internet, being so new, I mean, even now, when you say to someone, I have a blog, they go, how do you make money from that?
Yeah, exactly. That? People, it's like you saying, yes, I'm a serial killer.
People are very surprised by it. Yeah. So in those early days, lots of people are reading it. You know that because they're feeding back?
Yeah, lots of comments.
Lots and lots of comments. And that was the primary thing for you. And were you doing anything with sponsored stuff, or were you just not...
Nope, I didn't. I had to click through to Lakeland. Okay. And the deal with Lakeland was, we will pay you when your earnings reach over £50.
Yeah, and click throughs are awful.
And like, that was 11 years ago. Yeah, and I've still not had a payment from Lakeland.
Yeah. I
know. So click throughs don't work.
No.
No, I viewed it as a showcase for my writing, and then I would get commissions. Fine. And I did. I got lots of commissions from people.
Okay.
My little friends started becoming more important. They would commission me. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, for quite a long time, quite a, you know, reasonably sort of healthy freelancing career.
You are doing your blog, it's successful.
Yeah.
At what point do you have children? At what point does a spike become a thing?
Yeah. So Recipe Rifle started as a cookery only thing, and then I had children, and then it went crazy. Then it became really, you know, big.
Yeah.
I wrote about, and you know, I didn't know anything about having kids. It's again pre-Instagram, none of that. I wrote about, so I got pregnant with Kitty, we got married in 2010, and I got pregnant with Kitty immediately, bit embarrassing, and then had Kitty in 2011.
Okay.
And I could
That is really quick.
I know. I mean, disgusting. But Giles is 11 years older than me, so he really wanted to get on with it. And he loves babies and just really wanted to have children. So I went, might as well just get over and done with. And I just couldn't believe what I was expected to do with this child. I was like, are you kidding me? And so, what? And again, because I just had to write about it, right. And I was one of the first people really to be writing about the kind of the nightmare of having children in a kind of jovial but realistic way. And there was no, but then she smiled and everything was okay. But it was all worth it in the end. I was like, this is a nightmare, you know, and people really love that because it is a nightmare. And the fact that you love your children goes without saying. And the fact that she smiled and it was okay in the end goes without saying.
Yeah.
You know, people don't need help loving their children or having a good time with their children.
Yeah.
People need help when they're sitting there thinking, I can't do this anymore. Waking up every morning and going, I hate my life. I can't do this. This is a nightmare.
Yeah.
So I went for that. And I went for also cooking for children, cooking for a family, cooking when you just can't be asked.
Yeah.
All of that, children being ill.
And were you cooking all your meals? I mean, were you quite good at...
Yes, I've always made room to cook stuff.
Okay, and where did the way you look fit into this? I mean, I know about your weight, but were you bothering with makeup?
No, I didn't. I made an effort to put some eyeliner on.
Okay.
Yeah, eyeliner's always been...
I can't imagine you without eyeliner.
It's a real shock, I don't. I was incredibly overweight. Yeah. Nothing fit. I didn't really care. I was like, oh god. I mean, I quite often just slop about the house wearing horrid clothes.
Yeah.
That comes quite naturally to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I see that, you know, now where we live in Kentish Town, and there are these women with babies that they look fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, they just had babies and they look all sort of smart and kind. But I think Instagram and Pinterest has made it easier to get dressed.
Ish, but I live in Queen's Park where there are a lot of very yummy mummies.
Yeah.
And they like literally walk around wearing like white jeans with a white shirt tucked in, and they're like, you know, like 8 stone, and they have their baby who looks like 2 weeks old.
Yeah.
I don't understand it because I can't look like that as a, you know, childless person.
Yeah,
so I don't understand how they do that.
It's they just have to, do you know what? They just have to, you just have to want to.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to, you know.
When you say you swap around in clothes,
yeah.
So I obviously you write a lot about fashion now. Do you have someone, Kylie, who came on the podcast, said that she has...
Heaven.
Yeah, but she says she has a between dressing mode, where it's not bed clothes, and it's not the stuff she'd wear out the house, but there's like a kind of middle zone of tracksuit, t-shirt. Do you do that too?
Oh, yes.
Because you're wearing like jeans at the top today that I would very happily wear anywhere.
Yes.
Like, this is not your slopping around clothes, presumably.
No.
Okay, fine.
Heavens,
you are dressed properly.
No, I'm dressed for visitors. Okay. I'm just to receive a visitor.
Yes. Yes.
If I'm not really going to see anyone, or if I'm just going to go out the road for groceries, and if quite often, and if I'm just sort of feeling, you know, disappointed with the world, it's quite often I mean, nothing I'm ashamed of. Do you know what I mean? I think that, you know, a lot of between dressing, as Kylie would say, is perfectly acceptable as long as everything is relatively new and clean.
Yes.
Like sort of a newish pair of tracksuit bottoms,
yeah,
a clean t-shirt,
yeah,
you know, maybe a little necklace, smart denim jacket, a clean pair of trainers. And actually, there's quite a lot of places you could go dressed like that, but you're still comfy and it's still fine.
Do you know who says, Marie Kondo says that as long as you feel that the stuff, that you are wearing something that has integrity to your, you know, like it's a good, proper, clean, you don't have stains on it, you don't feel it's revolting, then you can wear whatever you want. But she said all your comfy clothes should be stuff that you're proud of. Yeah. In some way, because it shouldn't be revolting.
Mm.
And actually, I really took that on board and started doing that. And I feel much better when I'm sitting there writing at my laptop and no one's looking at me. At least if I'm wearing like nice, clean tracksuit bottoms and a nice kind of t-shirt, I feel better about life. It really impacts me.
I love the way that the clothing industry and fashion and style is going at the moment. The fact that you can meet a woman who is clearly really majorly important in any possible sphere, and she's probably wearing a pair of flat shoes.
Yeah.
And she's probably wearing, she might be wearing a pair of, you know, really, maybe like Me and M, really expensive, but a pair of track trousers.
Yeah.
And a shirt, and her hair maybe sort of tied up. And you just think, this just would not have been acceptable 15 or 20 years ago.
Do you know what? Two nights ago, I was watching Remy and Michelle's High School Reunion.
You were. I saw that.
I hadn't watched for years, but when they pretend to be executives and they wear those those suits, I mean, it was very much like, I'd love to do that for a day. You know, that 90s kind of power suit with stilettos, with hair up in a bun. And I thought, I've never met a businesswoman who looks like that. I meet businesswomen who wear trainers and, you know, and just, and even I know that the magazine writing industry is a bit more relaxed, but even I used to work in the city, and even then it was a lot more relaxed. You know, it's a very, it's a very interesting time for fashion.
It is. It's a very, it's a very interesting time for women in fashion, definitely. Yeah.
Now, is that what brought you Recipe Rifle to the spike?
Well, Recipe Rifle was unsustainable because there was so much, there was a huge amount of physical effort that went into it, actually cooking new things. I'd got to the end of the things that I was interested in cooking. I could cook a vast amount of things, and I just, you know, that was kind of the end of it for me. And, you know, people liked it because there was so much pain in there. There was so much pain about having children, despair, you know, lots of, you know, descriptions of daily life with kids. And first of all, I felt like it wasn't fair to write about my children anymore. I think it got to the point where they did not choose to be the children of two writers. And I just thought, this is enough now. I think they deserve their privacy.
Okay.
You know, it sounds a bit kind of uptight. But I did feel like that. I thought, this is wrong.
Okay.
You know? So I stopped writing. I wanted to stop writing about them. I wanted to stop writing about food. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, like I said before, I mean, there's a lot of ugliness when in bringing up very small children. I mean, you were face down in the brown for a long time. And I just wanted to think about and look at beautiful things for a change. I wanted to just write about perfume or, you know, a lovely day out at a park or something without betraying the original message of Recipe Rifle. I also love just abandoning something. And people go, why leave Recipe? You worked through that, and I'm like, no, right, tear it all down and start again.
I love doing that.
I love it. I love just going, no, throw it all away and start again.
Is it because you like new beginnings, or do you just kind of like basically it's like a clean slate?
I love a clean slate. I'm not scared of a clean slate at all. I'm just like, right, start again, right, zero, or set it back to zero, start again. I think you should never be afraid of doing that. Okay. It's like when you've written 500 words and you go, no, this is all wrong, just delete everything and start again.
It's taken me years to feel comfortable deleting stuff.
Yeah,
it's really hard. Yeah.
But the thing is that what you should always think when you're writing is that no piece of writing is a waste of time.
Yeah.
Because even if you delete it, it informs what you next write.
Yeah,
true. Even if you're not actually just copying it out, you go, that was good, but I could do it differently.
Rebecca once said to me, one of the best bits of advice she had about writing was, write your stuff and then delete the first paragraph, because it's usually always some bullshit you don't need.
Yeah, throat clearing. It's called throat clearing. It's meaningless. And and then, because you start getting the good, about three quarters of the way through, hello, now I'm flying.
Yeah.
And then you run out of words.
Yeah.
So you've got to get rid of the first third. Always, always. So I started the spike and I lost a lot of readers because they were there for the pain. They were there for, there was blood on the floor every day at Recipe Rifle. It was like, oh, my marriage is shit and my children are awful. And that's, that's what they were there for, and that's fine. They didn't come across the spike, but I got lots of new people and I much preferred it. It was much easier.
And in terms of just blogging in general, how did the people you knew at newspapers, the people you knew in, I want to say proper journalism, how did they receive you going into blogs? Was there any snobbery?
Not to my face, probably behind my back. I mean, they probably just sort of assumed that I couldn't get work, which was, I was getting work, but not enough to fill the entire day. And also, the thing is, as time went on, and more recently, the things that newspapers and magazines expect you to do, the things they want you to write about, what they expect in terms of photo shoots, hour dedication, for the money that they've got, I don't know who's doing it. I just don't understand. And then suddenly, a thing called affiliate links came out, which meant that you could write about, I'm sure they'll know, but it's like a fence between brand and blogger. So they kind of broker a deal between your blog and the brand so that you get a percentage of somebody's basket if they click through to them. And there are two main companies that do it, Awin and RewardStyle. And once I was signed up with both of them, you can write about whatever product you fancy. You don't have to only write about kind of Habitat and ASOS. You can write about whatever you like. And you will get a commission if someone clicks through. And that made a massive difference. Because the readers of The Spike are, trust me, which they should do because I tell them the truth. And they're incredibly loyal. And they have a vast disposable income, as it turns out. And so the money coming in through affiliate links was easy, it was honest, and it was way over and above what I would be earning from commissions.
When did you start Spike?
4 years ago.
Okay, and was it instantly successful?
It was up and running much quicker than Recipe
Rifle. So you already had an audience who was sort of new.
Yes, I already had an audience.
Okay, and so you're at the stage now where you're doing both magazine work, magazine, newspaper, blog, and you're kind of building yourself as a brand.
It's so cringy, but
I know, but that is what's happening. I mean, that's kind of the way it goes now. And do you see that going on for a while? Like, what's your plan for the next?
Do you know what? I don't really have a plan. I don't know. I mean, it's so hard to say, but I do know that when I was younger, especially when I was at school, being seen to try was not a thing that you ever did. You had to just be
back then. You
just had to be miraculously successful in some way, and it looked like you hadn't lifted a finger. Mostly in my sort of area, it was getting a book deal or writing a book, and the book being an instant success. And obviously, writing a book is like writing a book makes having children look like a walk in the park. I mean, writing a book is really, really, really hard. Getting the publishing industry, oh my god, what I've seen of it, total nightmare. And I would never write a book that was successful anyway, so there's no way I was going to do that. But now, what with millennials, trying is no longer embarrassing.
Yeah,
trying is not embarrassing.
That's one of the biggest shifts, I think.
It's amazing. It's so amazing. Different.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah,
the thing is that you can put yourself out there, and people basically don't shoot you down.
Yeah, It's a bit like Victoria Beckham, though. If you look at her, I mean, yes. 20 years ago, she'd have been considered to be a total embarrassment. But now people are like, what a grafter.
What a grafter. She's really trying.
Yeah.
And I saw the front page of a magazine a couple of weeks ago that said that it was a napkin and a pen. And it said, this is all you need to start a business.
Yeah.
And I suddenly thought, oh my God, yes, right. I've got to do something about this. So that inspired me to hire a web designer to turn my blog into a website.
I've got a note here about insecurities. I know I mentioned that before, but you did say in a blog post, which I love the spike and read it. So all your little words are somewhere in the back of my head. All your little words. God, that sounded patronizing. You know what I mean? Your words are there.
I can definitely be big words.
Those tiny words. No, but you did say at one point that I think it was about dressing, and you said, you know, when I first got jealous, I had lots of fancy friends, and I hadn't been used to that. Did that genuinely make you feel slightly insecure? Did you think, oh God, actually, I've got to step up here and buy lots of Melissa Odebash?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, as I said before, you know, I walk around, and I've always walked around going, but I'm the best.
Yeah.
But I'm the best, and my clothes are fantastic.
Yeah.
And people say, oh wow, that's so great. It's not, because you come up against other people who are just doing better than you, if you're naturally a bit more kind of timid, you think, oh, of course, that's the way it should be. If you're like me, you'd go, what? And it's a real, kind of slap in the face, you know, because you go, but hang on a second, I'm the best.
Yeah.
And then you're so obviously not the best. Anyway, they're all of Giles's friends. So Giles is 11 years older than me. So most of his friends and his friends' wives are much older than me, which actually is amazing because they are so accomplished. They're so lovely because they've always been so lovely to me because we're not in competition. Do you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, how old are her children? What's she doing with her kids?
Blah, blah.
They just looked at me kind of benevolently and just like, oh, well, you know, we all find our way in the end kind of thing. And they were so sweet. And they're all incredibly accomplished, very successful in their own right. One of my husband's friends is a guy called Johnny Hornby. He's married to Claire Hornby, who is the CEO of Me and M Clothes, which is now huge. Mm-hmm. When we met, it was kind of smaller, but still successful. Yeah. And now it's sort of massive.
Yeah.
Another one of my husband's friends, his wife's called Anna Bateson, who is just like, literally, like, I just go, where did you get that? How do you do your life? Tell me your secrets, you know. And she always looks amazing, beautiful clothes. She's really good with numbers. Mm. She's always had these massive jobs at telly companies, but she's also still really nice.
Yeah.
And reads books and is interesting. And she's just amazing. So these amazing women they would go on holiday with them, and Giles would like, right, we're packing in one suitcase only. And I'm like, he feels like it's a competition who could bring the less luggage. So I'll go, okay, fine. And I'll turn up on holiday with like two dresses. And these amazing women, they would come down to breakfast in like Anna would be wearing this amazing sort of nightgown. And it would be the most beautiful fabric I'd ever seen. Like hand block. And I'd go, oh my God, where did you get that? And she would say, oh, this is from the cross or something. And she didn't say it like that. She would just go, oh, it's from the cross.
Yeah.
Because she's not a dick. She's like, oh yeah, it's from the cross. I was like, the cross, what's the cross? What the hell is the cross?
Yeah.
I'm looking up the cross. And I would look up this nightgown, and it would be sort of £400. An amount of money I couldn't conceive of spending on anything. Mm. Maybe an appliance.
Yeah.
But certainly not a dress. And I just thought, my God, I've got to sort myself out. I've really got to sort. I am not the best. I'm not Elizabeth Taylor. This requires work.
Yeah.
And it was then, I was about maybe, I don't know, 30, I realised that looking nice for other people is polite.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you should do it. If you're not naturally motivated to look pulled together, it is polite to look nice and to put your jewellery on and to wear clean clothes and say hello. It's nice to look at other people looking nice. And also, it's work. Mm-hmm. It's hard work. It's like doing your house. It's like bringing up your children to say please and thank you. It doesn't happen by itself.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have nice clothes to wear, you have to look for them.
Yeah.
And they can't all come from Hennies. H&M, sorry. Nobody calls it Hennies anymore. They can't all come from H&M. Some of them can come from H&M, not all of them.
Yeah.
So that was the point that I thought, oh my God, I've just got to throw all my clothes away and start again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wrote about that.
But it's interesting that you took to that, like, this is a challenge rather than,
No, it's all copy.
Yeah.
It's all copy. And also, I want to be the master of everything. Yeah, I want to be the best at everything. I don't want ever to feel on the back foot about anything.
Okay.
Because when you grow up with three sisters who, and in that competitive environment, you always want to be like, right, I've got it sorted. Now yeah. I've got it sorted out.
Yeah.
A big problem solver. I love a solution. Mm. So the clothes thing, I really wanted to get on top of that because I'd always had a nice figure and been young and slim. And then suddenly you're overweight because you've had children and you're not young anymore.
Yeah.
And your clothes have got to work a little bit
harder. And you need to understand clothes.
Yes.
Tell me about being two writers in a household.
Yeah, right.
questions that immediately come to mind. One, do you read each other's work or comment on it prior? I'm presuming you read it after, at the end.
Yeah.
But prior to it going to an editor.
Yeah.
Does criticism... So my husband sometimes reads my stuff. He's a good writer, but he isn't a writer. But sometimes he reads my stuff and he goes, oh, I don't know about that. And I want to murder him.
No, that's not a thing.
So tell me about that and that dynamic.
I never let Giles read any of my stuff until it's gone to print.
Does he subscribe to your blog?
Yes, he does, actually. Okay. Yes, he does. He doesn't like The Spike as much as he liked Recipe Rifle.
Okay.
But people don't.
He's not target audience, though, is he, really?
No. But he thought that the writing at Recipe Rifle was better. He thought the subjects were more interesting. And I said, yes, but tough.
One more question for you before we go on to your final product.
Yeah.
And it's about being nice, right?
Being nice.
Now, it's funny you brought up being nice, because I was actually talking about you the other day with someone and saying how kind you've been to me, right? Which is not something that you encounter a lot in this industry. It's a very cutthroat industry.
Yeah.
And one of the words that when I was sort of writing my notes on you, one of the sort of six words that came up was kind.
Mm.
So it's funny that you've gone, well, I wasn't kind. Right. And then I had to learn. Would you say that's now become something that you are?
Yeah. But yes.
And it's as important to you as all the other
stuff.
So
important. It's so, 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 so important to be kind. It's so important. And it's really easy.
Yeah.
It's really easy to be kind, but not a massive pushover.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to be all of those things.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if one were to be a little bit sort of spiritual about it, it all comes back to you in the end. It just does. I've seen it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to be sitting there going, has this thing happened to me because I'm a bitch?
Yeah.
Because it's not, who knows?
Yeah.
It might. So being kind, it also... Once you allow yourself to just be really nice and be really kind and thoughtful, it's really easy and it's kind of a relief, you know, just to be like, of course, how are you? You know, are you okay? Can I get you anything? You know, being kind and being nice is very disarming as well. And I think kindness can also be slightly aggressive. Like, a big, ferocious smile.
Yes.
You can't escape from that.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? You know, some Instagrammers, there's been one or two kind of, but slightly nervous Instagrammers who come across a bit, like, horrid.
Yeah.
But if you just go, I just love your stuff. It's so joyful. And I love that advert you did. It was really fun.
Yeah.
They go, oh my God. Because as you did say, it is really cutthroat.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, a way of getting around that, if you want to, is by being the big, magnanimous, lovely, kind person as far as you can.
Yeah.
Not like I'm famous for being so nice, but I certainly... what's the point in being mean to someone's face? I mean, I would just assume, from my personal experience, they'll just go around going, oh, God, this is a bit of a bitch, isn't she?
Yeah,
and that's horrible. I don't want that. No. Who wants that?
Okay. Products.
Yeah.
Final products. What are you using now? What are you loving now?
So, because of you, because you're so amazing, I really, you know, genuinely, honestly, I mean, only people with bad skin or with breakouts and spots will understand what this means when somebody cures their skin for them. It's just like, it's amazing. So I've always had, you know, breakouts and then you find a solution and then that stops working and then you have to find another one. Mm. But my most recent one was like, my jawline, honestly, it was like 100,000 sea monsters had woken up from a sleep and had just vomited on my face. It was awful.
Mm.
Giant pustules like I haven't had since I was a teenager.
Mm.
I don't really cry that easily these days, but I was very nearly on the verge of tears. I would look at, what am I going to do? And I can't right now. I think you just kind of, you contacted me unilaterally, I think, and said, look, I really feel your pain about your skin. I think you should just stop using whatever you're using. Yeah. And I was using like vinegar on my face, literally taking a sandpaper,
yeah.
And you said stop using everything you're using and start using Exuviant.
Yeah.
And the, I don't know if it's Exuviant or what, but those vitamin serums, Alpha H vitamin serums, and you said use them like this, do that, use your SPF, clean your brushes. And I'm not, because I've had a lot of, I've taken antibiotics.
Yeah.
And used progesterone cream for my skin in the past.
Yeah.
So I've always thought that it's an internal thing. It's a hormone thing. It's a thing. I don't really believe that topical products can really change your skin.
Yeah.
And within 48 hours, it was all clearing up.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great.
You're like, God, I didn't realize it was really that good. Yeah. But it really was. It was something. It was, you know, I have a problem... with vitamin D, maybe it was a vitamin. I mean, I take my vitamins.
It's hard to know though, isn't it, for skin? I think that's the thing, that it's so much of it is internal. I mean, I get lots of spots. That definitely is internal. But using good topical skincare keeps it under control.
Mm.
So it's like my skin from the inside is still boshing,
yeah.
But I'm kind of going, no, stop.
Like a naughty dog.
And sometimes it doesn't work as well as other times. Yeah. But I think you have to have that routine.
Yes, definitely. And also I was using, I mean, God knows what sort of crap I was using on my skin.
I mean, I used to use I won't name brand names, but you know that stuff that you use when you're a teenager and you kind of have the toners that are made of basically alcohol.
Alcohol, yeah.
And I'd swipe them over my skin maybe 7 or 8 times a day because they instantly felt like they were drying, not realizing that it was just sending my skin into this mad cycle. And it's just, it's impossible.
I wasn't using rubbish on my skin before, but
But also, this is where I think, and God, like, I love magazines, I work for magazines, but this is where I think a shortcoming definitely is with magazines, where they'll say, this is the new trend, like, use this, everyone should be using hyaluronic, everyone should be using, etc. And actually, it's better to treat your skin as if you were treating an illness than it is to treat it to this general, you could be better, you know, most people are battling something, so go in with that first, and then go to general beauty.
It's also, there's so much available, you know, there's so much stuff out there, you know, and even like something like The Ordinary, which is everyone raves about. I put a thing on my website, about The Ordinary, and people are still baffled by it. Yeah. People still send me emails going, I really still don't understand The Ordinary. And I'm like, neither do I.
It is
just baffling. And actually, going to a really good facialist, not just like, would you like the lavender or the sandalwood? You're going to a really good facialist who are hard to find and hard to get an appointment with.
Yeah.
Is what you need if you've got tricky skin. And if you hadn't suggested those magic creams to me, that is what eventually I would have done. But, you know, people feel like a lot of people feel like it's vanity to really sort of fret about your skin. Which it isn't, because if your skin is okay, everything else is fine. You know, everything else is manageable. Or is that ridiculous?
No, I think it's true.
If that is a ridiculous amount of like weight, it just means I haven't got any problems.
No, basically. Hundreds of makeup artists say that the thing that they spend most of their time on is prepping skin. And then it's just a case of, do we add a bit of eyeliner?
Yeah.
You
know,
it's
more
like
eyeliner?
It's like if your skin looks juicy and perfect, what's left to do?
I know.
Just a bit of, But tell me which eyeliner you're wearing and then I'll let you go.
I know. I wear Bobbi Brown long wear.
Oh, do you?
Yes. Cool. I wear whatever's to hand, but the one I seek out, for first is my Bobbi Brown.
And it goes on your waterline, lower waterline.
Yes, waterline, and then all around, and then apply it again, and then a bit more.
You keep going.
I'll read it. I'm a bit worried that it's fallen off now. I'm going to go run down
there. No, it's there.
I reapply at lunchtime.
Yeah.
Mascara on. I didn't wear mascara when my children were little because I couldn't bother to take it off at night.
But you still put on eyeliner?
I used eyeliner, no mascara. For a long time.
Is it always black?
My mascara?
Yeah. No, eyeliner.
This is brown. This is all brown now.
Okay.
But I do use black. I don't care.
Yeah.
Just as long as just loads. Just loads of it.
Thank you so much for all your time. So that was Esther Corrin. I absolutely loved sitting and chatting with Esther. I think the thing that I love the most about Esther is that she's so authentically herself. She's not being nice or saying things just for the sake of it. She is completely and utterly at ease with herself, and it's really, really lovely and really refreshing. So I do hope you enjoyed that episode. I also hope that you will go and read and subscribe to The Spike. It really is a cracking
website. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back next week with a brand new guest. So see you then. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.